Now, it's really important to get the numbers for diagnosis of diabetes right. And there are three key numbers to remember. 7, 11.1, 48. 7, 11.1, 48. We'll talk about these numbers in a second, but remember you need one result to be positive if someone has symptoms of diabetes, like polyuria, polydipsia, or weight loss, for example. But you need two results to be positive if it's someone without any symptoms. So what do these numbers mean? Your 7 relates to the fasting glucose level. So a fasting glucose level of 7 or more is a positive result. Your 11.1 reflects two different tests, a random glucose level and a post-OGTT, or oral glucose tolerance test, glucose level. If either of these are 11.1 or more, it's a positive test. And your 48 relates to your HbA1c. So if your number is 48 or above, it's a positive result. Remember, if you have someone with symptoms of diabetes, you just need one of these values to be high for a diagnosis to be made. If someone doesn't have any symptoms at all, then you need two positive results for it to be a diagnosis of diabetes. And you also have two other conditions to remember: IFG, impaired fasting glycemia, and IGT, impaired glucose tolerance. I would see both of these as pre-diabetes. They're almost diabetes, but not quite there. So IFG is when you have a fasting glucose result between 6.1 and 7. So it's not quite hit that 7 cutoff. IGT is when you have an OGTT test and the result ends up between 7.8 and 11.1. So not quite at the 11.1 cutoff. Now, statins are very commonly prescribed, but we should avoid them in certain situations. So if you have questions where patients have a history of things like active liver disease, transaminases that are 3 to 4 times the normal limit, if they're pregnant or breastfeeding, then statins should be avoided. What are the common side effects of statins? We all think about myalgia or muscle pain, but remember things like headaches and GI disturbance are probably much more common. Disease. Celiac disease is an autoimmune disorder against gluten. So when gluten contacts the bowel, it damages the lining of the small intestine, which can ultimately lead to malabsorption and weight loss. Now, gluten is generally found in wheat, in rye, and in barley foods. In terms of testing for celiac disease, we'd be looking for antibodies, usually an IgA, TTGA, or a tissue transglutaminase antibody first line, or looking at EMA, so endomycial antibody second line, if you can't check a TTGA. And remember, if questions ask about what to do with gluten until the blood test, the advice is that you keep on eating gluten-based foods until the blood test, otherwise the test is likely to be inaccurate. If the blood test for antibodies comes back positive, we should refer to a GI specialist for things like a small intestine biopsy, where they're looking for subtotal villus atrophy. Treatment for celiac disease is a gluten-free diet. And remember, you may get questions about a classic rash that appears with someone with celiac disease, and the general one that comes is dermatitis herpetiformis. And finally, of the big four, we'll cover mitral stenosis. So a very tight mitral valve leading to reduced blood flow from the left atrium to the left ventricle. The commonest cause of mitral stenosis is rheumatic fever, and it can lead to things like breathlessness, atrial fibrillation, and classically hemoptysis. You have your mid-diastolic murmur, you may see a raised JVP, a classic malar flush on the face, and a loud S1 sound. You can have medical treatment for symptomatic control, but generally surgery is recommended. For example, PMC, or percutaneous mitral commissurotomy, or valve replacement. If it's viral meningitis, it's mainly a supportive treatment pathway. Sometimes there's a role for antiviral medication. If we suspect bacterial meningitis, then initial treatment should be IV or IM benzyl penicillin. Remember, for adults and children over 10 years of age, the dose is 1.2 grams of benzyl penicillin. If a child is between 1 and 9 years of age, the dose is 600 milligrams of benzyl penicillin. And if they're under 1 year of age, the dose is 300 milligrams of benzyl penicillin. Next, we move on to subconjunctival hemorrhage. This can look quite scary. It's bleeding from a conjunctival or episcleral vessels into the subconjunctival space. It's usually asymptomatic. It happens spontaneously, but it can happen as a result of trauma, sneezing, or things like underlying bleeding disorders. If we get questions on this, we should be checking the blood pressure. But generally, it's a benign condition. It's self-limiting, and it should settle itself. The severity of a community-acquired pneumonia can be assessed using the CURB 65 score. You have 1 point for each of 5 components, and you can work out the severity by adding up the points. C is looking at confusion, so an AMT of less than 8 would give you 1 point. U is looking at urea, so a urea of greater than 7, again you get 1 point. R is looking at respiratory rate. A respiratory rate of greater than 30 would give you 1 point. B is looking at blood pressure. So a systolic blood pressure of under 90 or a diastolic blood pressure of under 60 would give you 1 point. And the 65 relates to the age of the patient. So if a patient is age 65 or more, you have 1 point. Remember HELLP syndrome. It's a more extreme presentation of preeclampsia. H-E-L-L-P. H is hemolysis, E-L is elevated liver enzymes, L-P is low platelets. And remember, the risk of preeclampsia is that it can lead to eclampsia, which are those seizures. So it's an admission to hospital. Antihypertensives may be needed, usually labetalol, but things like methyldopa, nifedipine, and hydralazine can also be used. And the only real cure for preeclampsia is delivery. Let's move on to a few other congenital abnormalities, and we'll start with PKU, or phenylketonuria. This is an inborn error of amino acid metabolism due to absent phenylalanine hydroxylase, which leads to high levels of phenylalanine. It's usually diagnosed by a newborn heel prick test, but it can present with very fair skin, blue eyes, and developmental delay. It's managed with a strict diet, for example, protein restriction. Now remember, in questions about knee injuries, there are certain things that you may pick up from the wording that can help suggest what potentially has happened. For example, words like twisting and pivoting can indicate an injured meniscus. Hyperextension can lead to anterior or posterior cruciate ligament injuries. Locking of a knee may suggest a meniscal injury or an anterior cruciate tear. The words popping or a tearing sensation may indicate a meniscal or ligamental tear. If you get knee swelling, look for whether it's a rapid knee swelling, which can suggest ligament rupture or a patella dislocation, or is it a slower knee swelling, for example, a day or so after the injury. This could, for example, suggest a meniscal tear. So what are some of the common signs and symptoms that you may get in questions about heart failure? Orthopnea, so the inability to lie flat. PND, or paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, i.e. waking up gasping for breath at night. Shortness of breath on exertion. And there may be a history of pink, frothy sputum with a cough. On examination, you may have bibasal crepitations. You may notice a raised JVP. There may be tachycardic. There may be a displaced apex beat. And you may hear a third heart sound, as well as seeing things like edema. On chest x-ray, classic changes are cardiomegaly, the presence of curly B lines, upper lobe blood diversion, and things like pleural effusions. Movements. Now, if there's a problem with the third nerve or the oculomotor nerve, it can present with three things, and it can remember this as P, PD, PDO. P is ptosis, so droopy eyelid. PD is pupil dilated, and PDO is pupil down and out. So a third nerve palsy gives you P, PD, PDO. Next, we'll talk about PMR, or polymyalgia rheumatica. Again, an inflammatory condition where we don't know the exact cause. It presents with bilateral shoulder pain and morning stiffness. For example, someone describing difficulty in brushing hair, as well as pain around the pelvic girdle. It's linked strongly with giant cell arteritis or temporal arteritis, and it can present with very high inflammatory markers such as ESR and CRP. Steroids are the only known effective treatment. Unlike giant cell arteritis, however, you can wait for assessment and you don't need to treat straight away. Once diagnosed, it's usually a 15 milligram once a day to start with dose, with gradual reduction, and it may need a few years of treatment. We'll discuss giant cell arteritis in more detail later on. Let's move on to OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. This is a condition where there are obsessions that are present, for example, recurrent unwanted thoughts or urges, like my hands are dirty, my hands are dirty, my hands are dirty. These then lead to compulsions or the need to act on them. So I must wash my hands if I feel that my hands are dirty. I must wash my hands if I feel my hands are dirty. Referral to psychiatry is recommended, and treatments are based around low-intensity psychological interventions first line, like CBT or what we call ERP, exposure and response prevention. But ultimately, SSRIs may be needed. For example, fluoxetine, paroxetine or sertraline, and sometimes clomipramine is used as well. Scabies is caused by bites from the parasite Sarcoptes scabii. Risk factors include things like overcrowding, homelessness, living in poverty, poor hygiene, and things like residential care homes. It presents with intense, widespread itching, especially at night, and you may see burrows in the finger webs, but you may also see papules, nodules, and secondary infections. To treat scabies, remember you treat all of the household, and you repeat treatment 1 week later, and first-line treatment is permethrin 5% dermal cream, but you can use malathion 0.5% aqueous liquid if permethrin is inappropriate. And next, we have tardive dyskinesia. These are stiff, jerky movements of the face or limbs, for example, lip smacking or tongue protruding or arm protruding, following long-term treatment with antipsychotic medication. Next, intra-abdominal injury. This could be blunt injuries, for example, in a road traffic accident, or a penetrating injury, for example, with a bullet. If it's a blunt intra-abdominal injury, then they may need serial examinations over time. There may be a classic Cullen's sign, which is bruising or swelling near the umbilicus, which may indicate retroperitoneal hemorrhage. Multiple investigations are needed, including urinalysis, for example, for blood, blood group and cross-match, ultrasound scans of the abdomen, CT scans of the abdomen, but ultimately things like laparoscopy and laparotomy may be needed as well. Moving on to thyroid cancer, remember there are different histological types of thyroid cancer. For example, papillary thyroid cancer, which is the most common, but also follicular, medullary, etc. The major risk factor for thyroid cancer is ionizing radiation exposure. And usually, patients present with a thyroid swelling or enlarged lymph glands. A variety of tests may be conducted, thyroid function tests, an ultrasound scan, fine needle aspiration cytology, MRI scans, CT scans, and maybe radionuclide imaging as well. The TNM staging system can be used, tumor nodes metastases, and treatment really does depend on a variety of things, but it could be a thyroidectomy where you take the thyroid gland out, radiotherapy, also things like radioiodine ablation.